Welcome to the AI and Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, the show where we spotlight the innovators and leaders who are transforming the future using the power of data and AI. I'm your host, Dean Gaeta, author, podcaster, and founder and CEO of Infogistics and Slingshot. We're living in an exciting era, a time where builders, leaders, and entrepreneurs are using data and AI to fuel unprecedented growth, create groundbreaking products, and drive meaningful transformations in their industry. If you're ready to learn from some of the brightest minds and uncover actionable insight to take your business to the next level, you're in the right place. And if you have a story to share, stick around until the end of the show. We'll tell you how you can become our next guest and inspire leaders around the globe. Welcome to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. Let's dive in. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. I'm really excited to have the Chief Product Officer, lots of experience, Jason Pinkethman, and he's with the Simpro Group, but I'm looking forward to this. We had a little pre-conversation before getting on the video here, and so I think it's going to be some really good information and conversation. So welcome, Jason, and you want to do a better job introducing yourself than I did?
All right. Thank you, Dean. Thank you for having me on your show. Yes, I'm the Chief Product and Technology Officer at Simpro Group. I guess you could say I started as an electronics and electrical engineer. That's my background. And I spent 35 years now in the industry working on hardware and embedded systems, and then finally in software as a service. And in all of my roles, I've basically been running product and technology teams. And I'm doing the same thing here at Simpro Group. I lead the product strategy and all the development for products, and the products that we're developing are for the trade services industries. So those are businesses that are HVAC, electrical, plumbing, fire and safety, the backbone infrastructure of what keeps industries running. And one of the roles, obviously, that I'm focusing on at Simpro Group is how we can take AI and make it useful in the real world, not just in the way that we are building software ourselves, but also make it useful for our customers, our tradespeople, because they obviously are on the tools, but they need to save time. They need to reduce errors. They need to make it easier for technicians and business owners to do their work, to trust the data that they've seen. And I think from the fact that I've seen a lot of technology transitions and evolutions through my career, I went through the whole mobile phone evolution, telematics and data management. And I just see AI as another huge opportunity. And so my focus is taking that technology and doing similar than what I've done with previous technologies to help businesses and customers.
Yeah, that's great. It's interesting. Like a lot of us are working on software that are people are in the office. And like, what are some of the like use cases or challenges or problems you want to solve with AI with tradesmen? They're in the field and there's certainly a lot of data. And but maybe you can just share what you guys are doing around that.
Yeah, I would say that the software that we're developing is the operational backbone. And everything from a one man in a van type of business through to a national business. And so our opportunity here is to help them with their complex workflows. They focus on service, maintenance, and project work. And a lot of technicians are more focused on wanting to have their hands on their tools. They don't want to be doing admin. And the business owners don't want them to be doing admin. They're valuable when they've got their hands on the tools. That's their skill. And there was one estimate from our own customer base. We surveyed our own customers, and they said that they estimate about 8 hours a week that technicians are focused on unproductive work, non-productive work. In other words, admin. Time they could have been using to fix a customer's problem and generate revenue. So a lot of businesses can drown in admin. And the software that we're focused on is around scheduling, quoting, invoicing, inventory management, customer communications, all the things that you would imagine or exist around a trades business. And so our job then for AI, obviously, is to improve the tools to increase clarity of information, the quality of information, the timeliness, just build efficiency into all these processes that exist.
Now, how will you use AI? What's an example in some of those things you talked about?
Yeah, we've released a number of features. One of the most recent ones actually was job notes. So imagine a technician, he's on site and his hands are all dirty and he's a plumber and everything, and he has to type in notes about what the work he's just done at a commercial site. And it could be a whole list of things. That takes time and he might not get it all right. So we've got the easy button now. It's the hit the AI button, and it'll, with one tap, the technician can generate clear, concise, professional job notes around what they've done on site. So where's that information coming from? Information's coming from information about that job that we already know, historical data that we already know about that customer and that technician himself, what materials he may have used, which are all part of our software. So all this information is coming in, and rather than him having to regurgitate it himself in a nice way, just hits the easy button. So that's a very simple use case of using AI. And that will reduce the non-productive part of it. And also, it reduces the burden on the back office people, because the administrators back in the office, they have to go and clean up notes, because those are the things that then go into invoices and other ancillary documentation, right? And so they have to waste time going fixing everything. So that's one area, just a very simple area that you can drive efficiency. But we've done a lot of in a lot of other ways too. We're creating AI assistants for the people in the office when they're importing invoices. They can import them and all the data just magically goes to the right spot. So all of these kind of efficiency tools.
Yeah, that's great. A lot of people are talking about agentic AI. We were just talking to the Gartner people, and they're like, yeah, a lot of people are talking about agentic AI and saying they have it, but I think most of us are still building it. And but there's such promise. Is that kind of your strategy? Is like go from the service technician, all this about the job. I guess they probably put in a little additional notes of what they did, and then you describe, then it flows to the back office. Some of that data comes out and in the invoice, and that's like an agentic workflow a little bit. But then, like, how do you guys look at that and keeping people in the loop? How do you guys design for that?
Yeah, 100%. That's exactly the opportunity. So we have our existing software that we're building ourselves, and some of it's monolithic and it's legacy. We've been building it for years. So what we can do is we can put an MCP wrapper around those functions. So now they become tools within our own software. And then we can have an MCP server in front of them, which is agentic, and that's controlled by an LLM. So our customers who are using our software interact with an LLM. I want to do A, B, and C. Help me. Now, the LLM instructs the MCP, the server, agentic server, to then go and do a whole range of tasks to complete what's needed for the customer. And the good news is about agentic is that it's recursive and iterative. And so it can perform a number of tasks and wait until it's done and then go back with the result. So we actually do have a number of agentic prototypes completed, and we're right now productizing them. One of them is actually our AI assistant. So within our normal software, just like any sort of SaaS software, you go into it, you see all the features and buttons and pull down menus and everything else. We will have an agentic workflow there. Our customers won't know it's agentic. They just see an assistant. But that assistant is now used, is doing it in an agentic way. So each of these tasks can be done behind the scenes and deliver the result. So the user, our customer, doesn't have to do multiple things.
Yeah, that's great. Did you put like an MCP server protocol in front of like all your legacy data so that then you can train the LLM on it and then your assistant can benefit from that? Is that what you guys did or?
Yes, that's essentially the way. I think you're touching on a really important point is the data, right? The data itself. And this goes back to every form of technology around data management. And I used to work at Talend, and I was working on data management, data pipelines. And at that company, we talked about, and this was for large banks, energy companies, healthcare companies, all the plumbing. We'd say that the data pipelines are the plumbing. Now I'm actually talking to real plumbers with real pipes. But the problem still exists. It's if the it's all about the data. If you don't have data that's well organized or structured. I know that LLMs can go through unstructured data and everything, but I'm talking about reducing the amount of hallucination in data.
Yeah.
You still have to have data that's chunked correctly, data chunking. so that LLMs and agentic approaches can get the data and do the jobs that need to. So we are spending quite a bit of time reorganizing our data, re-architecting it to work well in an agentic form. And that's a big task because it's being trained on that data. And then also we want to ensure that whatever we're delivering to the customer, it's accurate, it's not hallucinating.
So when you say like data chunking, is that because you want to reduce the context window that you're giving the LLM to have more accurate information and you're going more discrete steps? Is that what you mean? Or
yes,
you get just a better outcome? Is that what you mean?
Exactly. Because if you don't have the data chunk correctly, I think hallucinations is a data chunking issue. I'm not an expert in AI, let's just say that. But
yeah,
my primitive work on it, of course, for what we're doing, is that's what I'm seeing. And structuring our data into smaller discrete blocks and having it well organized so that agentic workflows can find the data that it needs and doesn't have to extrapolate or interpolate the data that's missing. You provide it with more discrete data chunks.
Yeah, great. You have a pretty good sized team there. I was just doing research before the call, and what are you guys doing like around with AI internally? And maybe you could touch also like how are you doing it with your own product teams and dev teams, and like where are you guys finding value?
So we're using AI broadly. We're using Copilot, GitHub Copilot, for all of our developers have access to that. And a number of them are also using Cursor. And we've not restricted developers to any particular tool, but we've given them a range of tools because we're finding that with certain code bases, certain Copilots, let's say, certain AI tools work better than others. For .NET, it's one. For ColdFusion and PHP, some of the older languages, it's another. And so we're letting teams go and use whatever tool they're getting the better results for. But we're finding the same thing as what you're seeing in the general industry, I think, is that it's very helpful to get started. The first 80% of the task is creating boilerplate software, and all that kind of stuff is done quite quickly. But it's not as good as solving complex problems. For example, we had a bug and it took some of our engineers a couple of days to try and figure out what was wrong, and they couldn't. And they ran everything through AI, every tool that they had, and it said the more obvious things. It's like your checklist, kind of like what you and I might get if we ask ChatGPT for something. Go do these 10 things. So you go do all those 10 things, it still doesn't work, right? So what do you do then? We go to our brightest engineers and they solve the problem.
Yep.
And I'm not sure if you've heard this, but I think you have, that talk about AI is going to take away the job of a software engineer.
Yeah.
All right. So let's imagine a world where we have no junior software engineers. We just have AI writing software. Okay, so who's going to fix the bugs, the complex issues? Our senior engineers. Great. Bring out the senior engineers. Where did the senior engineers come from?
Yeah.
They weren't just born.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the data pipeline.
They are developed. So what am I doing? I'm hiring junior engineers and I'm training them on software development principles because I still want to have senior and principal engineers that know what they're doing.
Yeah.
At least for a number of years, we're not going to be in any shape where our software is going to be written or done by AI. And also, you know, software is written for a reason, for customers, right? So having a sit-down conversation with a customer and understanding how they run their business, that's a human skill. I still think it's a human skill, especially when I talk about our trade businesses. They've got very manual processes in terms of invoicing, bills, and doing jobs on site. You've got to sit down with them, understand the workflow of their business. And they're quite complex in terms of, I'm not saying complex from a software perspective, complex in terms of running a business. And I don't think AI is going to be able to just jump in and build all that automatically. You still have to have human in the loop for all of this stuff. And then a lot of the issues that we see, complex ones, cannot be solved by AI. We're still solving them with humans. So I'm still investing heavily in human capital, in hiring people that are junior to train them. They're the future senior engineers of the future that we need to understand how everything works, at least at a system level.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We're going to need more engineers. And AI can put out a lot of code, but then someone has to still understand all that code. And then sometimes it's not good code, and you need people to understand it's not good code. And like you said, it can't solve some really complex architectural issues. And even as it gets better and better, it just means software engineers and the market, we can just build more solutions. So we all benefit now that we can write software and now we can have intelligence in our software. It just means we can solve a lot more problems.
Exactly.
And yeah, and so the demand and the supply of engineering is not there. And now we have even more solutions. So yeah, this is my kind of like Jason chiming on with you. Please study computer science. And nope, it is not, AI is not replacing any of that.
Oh,
It's just going to get better.
I've got a funny anecdote for that real world example. So now when we interview engineers, we give them challenges with AI. Basically, go build this. Here's a discrete problem to solve. Go solve it with AI and do that during the interview. And so we watch them, which tools they're using, how they implement it, how they debug, and all this kind of stuff, right? How do you use AI tools? So that's always very interesting because some have no idea and some are very good at it. And so we want to set the expectation that when they join our company, you're going to be using these tools.
Yeah.
So what's been interesting is we've taken fresh graduates. And we've given these challenges and they can't do anything. Do you know why? Because their teachers, their lecturers are saying you're not allowed to use these tools because that's cheating. Now, which I
Yeah.
understand. Back in the day, I wasn't allowed to take my programmable calculator into exam. I get it. But if you're bringing computer science graduates or engineers into the industry, they have to be able to use the tools that companies are expecting them to use.
100%, 100%.
And so I think that the education system also has to factor that in. I'm not saying free rein here, but they have to have the ability to use the tools that industry is expecting them to use.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. It's interesting you brought up, you worked for a software company that dealt with data and data pipelines, and then they were, I think they were bought by Qlik or, and like, what's your perspective on like, how do you get data ready for AI? What can you share there? Because it's a big part of solving problems.
Yes, I think the time that I had at Talon before they got acquired by Qlik was valuable in that context is that it's around data quality. I don't think that I think we've been talking about data quality for decades,
Yeah,
right?
we always have data quality issues.
It's still there, but I think it's also in where did that what's the source of that data? Can you trust the source of that data? Where did it originally come from? The source of truth. And so having that historization of data, I think, is also important. So having a source of truth that you can rely on it. If that data has been augmented or modified, can you still trust it? So I think it's not when I talk about data quality, I'm also like data trust in the data. And that stuck with me from that previous job. And now where I am now, it's very much the same thing. We have to have a single source of truth. And that anything that's been augmented needs to be tracked as augmented. And so that when we're using agentic tools or AI in any form, that we're using the correct source data. And then the other thing is just the organization and structure of that data. And again, that's something we've been talking about for decades.
Yeah.
And I think LLMs and other AI tools are better at dealing with unstructured data. Previously, we've always talked about you need structured data. I think that maybe it's diminished to some degree. The other thing I would talk about is integrations. Data pipelines and all forms of data rely heavily on integrations. And at the company I'm at now, Simpro Group, we're in an ecosystem. We don't just exist by ourselves. We have to interact with payroll systems and financial systems and inventory management and suppliers, all these companies that are delivering a lot of data. And again, you've got to think about where's the source of truth? How do you deal with conflict management of data? And then if you're using AI for this, you need to know that the data you're working with that's third-party data, is that also trusted? And then obviously we've got the whole privacy and security issues. So we're ensuring, as I imagine most companies are doing right now, is ensuring that all of the data is compartmentalized and only available to the customer that is using the data. There's always an opportunity for some high-level sort of BI that can look cross-industry, but all that has to be all abstracted and anonymized. But for the most part, we have to keep all our data very well segmented. And we have obviously some GDPR and other requirements that we want to meet on a regional basis. That's obvious. But I think data privacy and security is a big one. And if I'm just going to go a little bit further on that topic, our customers care deeply about that. And especially in a trades industry, if you imagine you've got a trade business, it's all about your customer interaction. I don't know who you use as a plumber or a technician or an electrician, but if you find a good one, you're going to stick with them, right? Oh, yeah. It's a loyalty business. It's by reputation. And if you build trust with a customer, you cannot lose that trust. So if we deliver software to them where there's a security, privacy, quality issue, we've just undone their business for them.
Yeah.
And gaining that back is going to be a lot of work.
Yep.
Our customers, if we delivered something like that, would drop us like a hot potato. And they've got to go repair a relationship with the customer. It would take them a long time for us to go build that trust again with our customer. So how do we do that? We have to do a lot of testing. That work notes feature I told you about earlier, we didn't just still deliver that. We had a proof of concept for that over a year ago. We launched it to 1,000 technicians in a field trial that ran 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah, because I wanted to be sure that this thing would work and that we didn't have those kinds of errors, because if you deploy something and there's an issue, forget about it. I don't know how long it would take to recover. So I'm over-indexing on testing and quality and doing a lot of user testing, getting a lot of customers involved in what we're doing to get that feedback loop in with our customer support, our sales even, product and engineering. They're all in that loop so that what we deliver doesn't erode that trust.
Now, did you have any like crazy aha moments from that 6 month trial?
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that. It's almost like you prepped me, but you didn't. Yes, we did. One thing was that technicians are really reluctant to use tools at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they didn't want to, even when you give them the easy button, they didn't want to press it. The people in the back office wanted them to press it because it saved them a ton of work. If they got bad job notes and work notes coming back from the work site, they had to go fix all that. It was their problem. Technicians just want to move on to the next job. Why should I help somebody else or whatever? I'm just going to get out of here, go to my next job. So there's behaviors that need to change. And even when you give them great tools, there needs to be an incentive or a trust to go use the tool. And that was something we uncovered, that actually AI might be, as efficiency tools, might be better for back office personnel than it is for a technician in the field. And if we are going to design something for the technician in the field, it has to be very specific for them to drive adoption.
Now, did you solve that problem? Did you figure out how to get them to use it?
I think so. We just launched it a couple of weeks ago. So let's see if these workflows solve the problem. But yeah, we wanted to make it easier to discover, easier for them to have trust in it, and give them options. So of how those work notes are put together, depending on.
Even like we run a good software team, but there's just always resistance to change. Even if you have a very technically inclined audience, change management is tough. And so
it is. Yeah, we're still a world full of people.
Yeah.
We're not all robots. Robots can just change by telling them to go do something. We're people. We have bad behaviors and good behaviors, and then neither are easy to change.
So what did you do? What you just shipped to get them to use it? What were some of the key things you did that you think will help get more adoption?
Oh, you mean in the actual software workflow?
Yeah. And your notes from the field technicians, how do you think you're getting them to use the software? Like what features did you add?
The features that we implemented to try and drive more adoption is giving them more options and more of human oversight.
Okay.
And I think we're seeing that in a lot of AI tools, is that if you automate too much, then, and there's without trust, then there's going to be reluctance to use the tool. So providing more control over an output. We have different options and buttons. So creating bullet points or paragraph form, or joining different notes together, and then having the ability to go through and change things and before you submit. So we're not at a point where anything can be fully autonomous. We still have to have the human in the loop.
Yeah.
Another example is on scheduling. So if you think about scheduling jobs, and some companies schedule hundreds and hundreds of jobs a week or thousands of jobs a week. And they've got people who sit in seats in an office scheduling work jobs. And you've got calendars and you've got technicians with different skill sets, different locations, different tools, multi-trades. It's very complex.
Yeah.
So that's another area that AI can be used. And so we're using AI in that area. But it's the same thing, though. You've got to have a human in the loop because you can't make an assumption that AI is going to provide the best opportunity to fill a calendar with all the scheduling for jobs that need to be done. Because what if there's something else? What if, Dean, you care more about customer A more than customer B? You want to over-index on that. So there's always nuances to things. I made a promise to this guy, so I need to prioritize him. There's always some consideration. So a scheduler doesn't want to have everything fully automated. They want to get me 80% there and then let me make the decisions for the last 20% because I still want to have control because I'm responsible for the outcome, for the result.
Yep.
They're the one with the job on the line.
I think that's like a huge insight because as a problem solver, you want to just like automate everything, make it really easy, but that's not practical as you just pointed out. And it might not be right also because of the nuances you also pointed out. And so, yeah, getting adoption and having that iterative interaction with the user and automating, but that I think that's like a huge point for everybody, anyone building solutions. So that I think that's a really good takeaway.
Yeah, I talk about it like internally, we want to have a vision, obviously a technology vision, but it has to be anchored in reality.
Yeah.
That's the reality piece of me, what you just said.
Yeah, that's great. And then what, like you as a leader, you've been a chief product officer and tech leader for a really long time. Like, how are things changing for you, how you run your teams? Like, how has AI impacted your own, how you get work done and how you work with teams and how you lead teams?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'd say it's still evolving. I was one of the first people to start using ChatGPT when that came out. And a lot of the people I work with jumped on that too, because we're all, say, explorers, right? People,
yeah.
I was pulling things apart when I was a little kid. That's how I became an engineer. And most of the people I work with are saying, right, how does this work? I'm fortunate that I work with a team of people who are naturally curious. Otherwise, they wouldn't have gotten into this field.
Yeah.
So I don't have the problem of motivating people to go explore. The challenge is providing them with the time to explore. And so a lot of this comes down to return on investment. And we focus on return on investment for our customers. In other words, we want to deliver a product that they're paying for that they need to see a return in it, obviously. Otherwise, they're going to say, what is the value?
Yeah.
So we focus heavily on return on investment for our customers. And internally, it's the same kind of thing. I can't allocate 50% of the engineer's time to go and explore AI because the return won't be there.
Yep.
I have to balance the needs of building our existing, say, software that's solving problems. I don't want customers calling me, why haven't you fixed that bug? Why are you building all this AI stuff when you haven't fixed 5 bugs that I've been waiting for months? And that's a fair question.
Definitely.
So you've got to focus on being pragmatic and allocating time to AI to give them the space to go and discover, and then at the same time, run the business.
Yeah.
So one thing that we've done, and this is relatively new, is I formed an AI task force. We call them like a guild, not like a secret society, but it's a guild, right? So anybody who is forward thinking on AI is a part of that guild, and then knowledge sharing. So that's where our first proof of concept came around with MCP and Agentic, and exploring all these different tools as they come out each week. So that guild is really the think tank, and they are free to spend as much time on that as they want. Usually in their after hours, I have to say, just because they're naturally curious, but they are allowed to spend a certain amount of hours per day working on that. And then in addition, I've got a dedicated development squads that focus on agentic work. And then for the rest of the teams that are embedded in their normal product line, we allocate a certain amount of bandwidth for them to do their own discovery too. So it's not easy. It's a balance. It's like, how do you balance how much time you spend doing bug fixing and how much time do you spend doing technical debt? Now we have to allocate, how much time do we spend exploring on AI?
Yeah, I think that's great. I like the pragmatic approach where you focus specific people, but you're still giving others the opportunity. And that's some really good advice there.
Now, and then there's the KPIs are important. And there's a number of tools out there that you can say, like, how much AI am I using and what's the return on investment? I've had very mixed results in those KPIs. They seem to be all over the map, because if we're writing complex code, it doesn't perform as well. And then if we're doing more boilerplate code, it performs really well. And like I said, different software code bases are different results too. So it's a very mixed bag. I would say that we're certainly getting a 20 to 30%, maybe even more improvement in efficiency in code generation. But there's so many edge cases to this, it's very hard. The best form of feedback or measure is actually just the anecdotal. Go and speak to engineers and ask them, how are they using it? Because they don't make stuff up, they tell you, oh, it was great for this, it was really bad for that. And the other thing is, you can't do really good A/B testing. I can't ask someone to go and develop something with AI and now go develop the same thing but don't use the tool and compare them. We don't have the time for that.
No.
Just get the work done the best way you can. So I don't know how to compare, and I haven't really seen good tools that can do it. There's a number out there, but I'm not really satisfied with them in a pure data sense. Can I trust it? They're all directional, which is fine. The best information I'm getting is actually sitting down with engineers and saying, how are you using it? How's it benefiting you? How's your day different?
Yeah, that's great practical advice. That's really good. And is there any question I didn't ask you that you wish I would have asked?
I suppose the one is, what will determine whether or not AI succeeds or fails for me and in the trade industry that I'm serving? And I think it does come down to some of the points we hit on earlier. It's around trust and return on investment, ROI. Tradesmen need to see a clear return. And for them, it's in time saved, avoiding risks and issues, having happier customers. And so if AI sticks, it'll be because it solved those problems. It can't overpromise and underdeliver. If it does, they'll simply go back to using pen and paper again, or Excel sheets, to manage their business.
Yeah.
So that leads me to think about something I think about often is, let's say 5 years from now, you and I are sitting 5 years from now, how are we going to look back at this time? Not just for the trades that I'm focused on, but for a lot of industries. And we say, was this really transformational? Was it revolutionary? Did it replace a lot of manual tasks? Did it make us more effective? Did it make our work easier, safer, higher quality? And I would say, if it's a yes, then I would say these next 5 years have been successful and we've leveraged and implemented the technology correctly. If we can't answer those questions positively, then I would say we missed the opportunity. And so that's the way I look at it. How am I going to look, how, where am I, when I sit in 5 years and look back on this, what does success look like?
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it. I think you'll hear some people say, maybe you only need to look out 2 years or 1 year. And then some people say, if you look in 5 years, you won't be working anymore.
So that might be my blind spot, right? That I think in the traditional sense that things take time, but AI is happening so fast that, timeline.
I'm with you. I'm more with you from your pragmatic thinking, that it's always somewhere. It's not going to be as great and it's not going to be as bad. It's really... you got to be pragmatic about this, and then you just keep, and then you stay focused on what you said, the customer value, and then trust. And I'm assuming your customers must be really hard to sell to, because of tradesmen, they're like hands-on, technical, and then maybe a little resistant to change and technology. And I don't know, so you might have a bigger task ahead of you than some of us, but...
The trades industries have some unique challenges right now. They are struggling with labor. They have a labor shortage. 60% of the customers we surveyed are reporting labor shortages. They're struggling with labor costs as well. A lot of the tradesmen are aging out, going into retirement. I know we've seen an influx of people entering the trades recently. It's been in the news, it's been reported on. But there's a gap. There's certainly a gap. And also in the trades industry, we're seeing that their customers, and that might be you and me and other businesses, our expectations are a lot higher. We expect to have real-time information. We expect very clear communication. And so that's putting a lot of pressure on field businesses, field service management businesses, to innovate and to hire more people and to use better tools. So there's a lot of pressure on the industry. But I think AI is an area which can actually help them and make that transformation, because some of them haven't even made the transformation from paper to software. We're still signing up customers that were using paper systems.
Yeah, I believe it. It's what you describe is in a lot of industries, just aging out skill set and not people coming in behind. And so, yeah, it's a huge problem out there. And so, yeah, software and AI might be able to help some of that. But also, we got to motivate the next generation and treat and train them. I mean,
Absolutely.
Can't get away from that. But
Totally
yeah,
agree.
Awesome. Thanks. I really appreciate you coming on the show, Jason. And if people want to reach out to you, get in touch with you, how can they find you or your company?
Best way is just to get me through LinkedIn, I think, because I'm searchable there and you can reach out to me through direct message and you can learn more about the company through there too. So just finding me on LinkedIn is probably the best.
All right, excellent. Thanks for being on the show, Jason. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dean. Nice to meet you.
Okay.
Bye.
Hey, it's Dean Guida here. Thank you so much for tuning in to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, where we showcase the visionaries who are shaping the future with data and AI. If you're a successful leader, entrepreneur, or business professional and want to share your story on this program, we'd love to hear from you. Visit us at podcast.slingshotapp.io to apply. Got something value out of this interview? Share the love. Take a quick screenshot, post it to your favorite social platform, or text it to a friend. Don't forget to tag the show and use the hashtag AI Data Driven Leadership. I love seeing your posts and suggestions for future guests. And if you know someone who would make a great guest, let them know about the show. We're dropping new episodes regularly, so don't miss out. Hit subscribe wherever you listen. And if you enjoyed this episode, a quick thumbs up, rating, or review would mean the world to me and my team. Want to stay connected? Visit our website at podcast.slingshotapp.io or find me on LinkedIn at Dean Guida and Instagram at DeanGuida89. Thanks again for listening to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. We'll see you next time.